This is Audible.
Blackstone Audio presents The Haunting of Hill House by Shirley Jackson. Dedication for Leonard Brown. Chapter 1. No live organism can continue for long to exist sanely under conditions of absolute reality. Even larks and katydids are supposed by some to dream. Hill House, not sane, stood by itself against its hills, holding darkness within. It had stood so for 80 years, and might stand for 80 more. Within, walls continued upright, bricks met neatly, floors were firm, and doors were sensibly shut. Silence lay steadily against the wood and stone of Hill House, and whatever walked there, walked alone. Dr. John Montague was a doctor of philosophy. He had taken his degree in anthropology, feeling obscurely that in this field he might come closest to his true vocation, the analysis of supernatural manifestations. He was scrupulous about the use of his title because his investigations, being so utterly unscientific, he hoped to borrow an air of respectability, even scholarly authority, from his education. It had cost him a good deal, in money and pride, since he was not a begging man, to rent Hill House for 3 months, but he expected absolutely to be compensated for his pains by the sensation following upon the publication of his definitive work on the causes and effects of psychic disturbances in a house commonly known as haunted. He had been looking for an honestly haunted house all his life. When he heard of Hill House, he had been at first doubtful, then hopeful, then indefatigable. He was not the man to let go of Hill House once he had found it. Dr. Montague's intentions with regard to Hill House derived from the methods of the intrepid 19th-century ghost hunters. He was going to go and live in Hill House and see what happened there. It was his intention, at first, to follow the example of the anonymous lady who went to stay at Belecken House and ran a summer-long house party for skeptics and believers, with croquet and ghost-watching as the outstanding attractions. But skeptics, believers, and good croquet players are harder to come by today. Dr. Montague was forced to engage assistants. Perhaps the leisurely ways of Victorian life lent themselves more agreeably to the devices of psychic investigation. Or perhaps the painstaking documentation of phenomena has largely gone out as a means of determining actuality. At any rate, Dr. Montague had not only to engage assistants, but to search for them. Because he thought of himself as careful and conscientious, he spent considerable time looking for his assistants. He combed the records of the psychic societies, the back files of sensational newspapers, the reports of parapsychologists, and assembled a list of names of people who had, in one way or another, at one time or another, no matter how briefly or dubiously, been involved in abnormal events. From his list, he first eliminated the names of people who were dead. When he had then crossed off the names of those who seemed to him publicity seekers, of subnormal intelligence, or unsuitable because of a clear tendency to take the center of the stage, he had a list of perhaps a dozen names. Each of these people, then, received a letter from Dr. Montague extending an invitation to spend all or part of a summer at a comfortable country house, old but perfectly equipped with plumbing, electricity, central heating, and clean mattresses. The purpose of their stay, the letter stated clearly, was to observe and explore the various unsavory stories which had been circulated about the house for most of its 80 years of existence. Dr. Montague's letters did not say openly that Hill House was haunted, because Dr. Montague was a man of science, and until he had actually experienced a psychic manifestation in Hill House, he would not trust his luck too far. Consequently, his letters had a certain ambiguous dignity calculated to catch the imagination of a very special sort of reader. To his dozen letters, Dr. Montague had 4 replies, the other 8 or so candidates having presumably moved and left no forwarding address, or possibly having lost interest in the supernormal, or even, perhaps, never having existed at all. To the 4 who replied, Dr. Montague wrote again, naming a specific day when the house would be officially regarded as ready for occupancy, and enclosing detailed directions for reaching it, since, as he was forced to explain, information about finding the house was extremely difficult to get, particularly from the rural community which surrounded it. On the day before he was to leave for Hill House, Dr. Montague was persuaded to take into his select company a representative of the family who owned the house, and a telegram arrived from one of his candidates, backing out, with a clearly manufactured excuse. Another never came or wrote, perhaps because of some pressing personal problem which had intervened. The other 2 came. 2. Eleanor Vance was 32 years old when she came to Hill House. The only person in the world she genuinely hated, now that her mother was dead, was her sister. She disliked her brother-in-law and her 5-year-old niece, and she had no friends. This was owing largely to the 11 years she had spent caring for her invalid mother, which had left her with some proficiency as a nurse, and an inability to face strong sunlight without blinking. She could not remember ever being truly happy in her adult life. Her years with her mother had been built up devotedly around small guilts and small reproaches, constant weariness, and unending despair. Without ever wanting to become reserved and shy, she had spent so long alone, with no one to love, that it was difficult for her to talk, even casually, to another person without self-consciousness and an awkward inability to find words. Her name had turned up on Dr. Montague's list because one day, when she was 12 years old and her sister was 18, and their father had been dead for not quite a month, showers of stones had fallen on their house. Without any warning, or any indication of purpose or reason, dropping from the ceilings, rolling loudly down the walls, breaking windows, and pattering maddeningly on the roof. The stones continued intermittently for 3 days, during which time Eleanor and her sister were less unnerved by the stones than by the neighbors and sightseers who gathered daily outside the front door, and by their mother's blind hysterical insistence that all of this was due to malicious backbiting people on the block who had had it in for her ever since she came. After 3 days, Eleanor and her sister were removed to the house of a friend and the stones stopped falling. Nor did they ever return. Although Eleanor and her sister and her mother went back to living in the house, and the feud with the entire neighborhood was never ended. The story had been forgotten by everyone except the people Dr. Montague consulted. It had certainly been forgotten by Eleanor and her sister, each of whom had supposed at the time that the other was responsible. During the whole underside of her life, ever since her first memory, Eleanor had been waiting for something like Hill House. Caring for her mother, lifting a cross old lady from her chair to her bed, setting out endless little trays of soup and oatmeal, stealing herself to the filthy laundry, Eleanor had held fast the belief that someday something would happen. She had accepted the invitation to Hill House by return mail, although her brother-in-law had insisted upon calling a couple of people to make sure that this doctor fellow was not aiming to introduce Eleanor to savage rites not unconnected with matters Eleanor's sister deemed it improper for an unmarried young woman to know. Perhaps, Eleanor's sister whispered in the privacy of the marital bedroom, perhaps Dr. Montague, if that really was his name after all, perhaps this Dr. Montague used these women for some, well, experiments. You know, experiments the way they do. Eleanor's sister dwelt richly upon experiments she had heard these doctors did. Eleanor had no such ideas, or having them, was not afraid. Eleanor, in short, would have gone anywhere. Theodora, that was as much name as she used. Her sketches were signed Theo, and on her apartment door, and the window of her shop, and her telephone listing, and her pale stationery, and the bottom of the lovely photograph of her which stood on the mantel. The name was always only Theodora. Theodora was not at all like Eleanor. Duty and conscience were for Theodora attributes which belonged properly to Girl Scouts. Theodora's world was one of delight and soft colors. She had come on to Dr. Montague's list because, going laughing into the laboratory, bringing with her a rush of floral perfume, she had somehow been able, amused and excited over her own incredible skill, to identify correctly 18 cards out of 20, 15 cards out of 20, 19 cards out of 20, held up by an assistant out of sight and hearing. The name of Theodora shone in the records of the laboratory, and so came inevitably to Dr. Montague's attention. Theodora had been entertained by Dr. Montague's first letter and answered it out of curiosity. Perhaps the wakened knowledge in Theodora, which told her the names of symbols on cards held out of sight, urged her on her way toward Hill House, and yet fully intended to decline the invitation. Yet, perhaps the stirring, urgent sense again. When Dr. Montague's confirming letter arrived, Theodora had been tempted and had somehow plunged blindly, wantonly, into a violent quarrel with the friend with whom she shared an apartment. Things were said on both sides which only time could eradicate. Theodora had deliberately and heartlessly smashed the lovely little figurine her friend had carved of her. And her friend had cruelly ripped to shreds the volume of Alfred de Musset, which had been a birthday present from Theodora, taking particular pains with the page which bore Theodora's loving, teasing inscription. These acts were, of course, unforgettable, and before they could laugh over them together, time would have to go by. Theodora had written that night, accepting Dr. Montague's invitation, and departed in cold silence the next day. Luke Sanderson was a liar. He was also a thief. His aunt, who was the owner of Hill House, was fond of pointing out that her nephew had the best education, the best clothes, the best taste, and the worst companions of anyone she had ever known. She would have leaped at any chance to put him safely away for a few weeks. The family lawyer was prevailed upon to persuade Dr. Montague that the house could on no account be rented to him for his purposes without the confining presence of a member of the family during his stay, and perhaps at their first meeting the doctor perceived in Luke a kind of strength, or cat-like instinct for self-preservation, which made him almost as anxious as Mrs. Sanderson to have Luke with him in the house. At any rate, Luke was amused, his aunt grateful, and Dr. Montague more than satisfied. Mrs. Sanderson told the family lawyer that at any rate there was really nothing in the house Luke could steal. The old silver there was of some value, she told the lawyer, but it represented an almost insuperable difficulty for Luke. It required energy to steal it and transform it into money. Mrs. Sanderson did Luke an injustice. Luke was not at all likely to make off with the family silver or Dr. Montague's watch or Theodora's bracelet. His dishonesty was largely confined to taking petty cash from his aunt's pocketbook and cheating at cards. He was also apt to sell the watches and cigarette cases given him fondly and with pretty blushes by his aunt's friends. Someday, Luke would inherit Hill House, but he had never thought to find himself living in it. 3.
"I just don't think she should take the car, is all," Eleanor's brother-in-law said stubbornly.
"It's half my car," Eleanor said. "I helped pay for it."
"I just don't think she should take it, is all," her brother-in-law said. He appealed to his wife. "It isn't fair she should have the use of it for the whole summer and us have to do without."
"Carrie drives it all the time, and I never even take it out of the garage," Eleanor said. "Besides, you'll be in the mountains all summer, and you can't use it there. Carrie, you know you won't use the car in the mountains."
"But suppose poor little Linny got sick or something, and we needed a car to get her to a doctor."
"It's half my car," Eleanor said. "I mean to take it."
"Suppose even Carrie got sick. Suppose we couldn't get a doctor and needed to go to a hospital."
"I want it. I mean to take it."
"I don't think so." Carrie spoke slowly, deliberately. "We don't know where you're going, do we? You haven't seen fit to tell us very much about all this, have you? I don't think I can see my way clear to letting you borrow my car."
"It's half my car."
"No," Carrie said, "you may not."
"Right," Eleanor's brother-in-law nodded. "We need it, like Carrie says."
Carrie smiled slightly. "I'd never forgive myself, Eleanor, if I lent you the car and something happened. How do we know we can trust this doctor fellow? You're still a young woman, after all, and the car is worth a good deal of money."
"Well, now, Carrie, I did call Homer in the credit office, and he said this fellow was in good standing at some college or other," Carrie said, still smiling.
"Of course, there is every reason to suppose that he is a decent man. But Eleanor does not choose to tell us where she is going, or how to reach her if we want the car back. Something could happen, and we might never know. Even if Eleanor," she went on delicately, addressing her teacup, "even if Eleanor is prepared to run off to the ends of the earth at the invitation of any man, there is still no reason why she should be permitted to take my car with her."
"It's half my car."
"Suppose poor little Linny got sick up there in the mountains with nobody around, no doctor."
"In any case, Eleanor, I'm sure that I'm doing what Mother would have thought best. Mother had confidence in me and would certainly never have approved my letting you run wild, going off heaven knows where in my car.
Or suppose even I got sick up there and..."
"I am sure Mother would have agreed with me, Eleanor."
"Besides," Eleanor's brother-in-law said, struck by a sudden idea, "how do we know she'd bring it back in good condition?"
"There has to be a first time for everything," Eleanor told herself. She got out of the taxi very early in the morning, trembling because by now, perhaps, her sister and her brother-in-law might be stirring with the first faint proddings of suspicion. She took her suitcase quickly out of the taxi while the driver lifted out the cardboard carton which had been on the front seat. Eleanor overtipped him, wondering if her sister and brother-in-law were following, were perhaps even now turning into the street and telling each other, "There she is, just as we thought, the thief, there she is." She turned in haste to go into the huge city garage where their car was kept, glancing nervously toward the ends of the street. She crashed into a very little lady, sending packages in all directions, and saw with dismay a bag upset and break on the sidewalk, spilling out a broken piece of cheesecake, tomato slices, a hard roll.
"Damn you, damn you,"
the little lady screamed, her face pushed up close to Eleanor's.
"I was taking it home. Damn you, damn you."
"I'm so sorry," Eleanor said.
She bent down, but it did not seem possible to scoop up the fragments of tomato and cheesecake and shove them somehow back into the broken bag. The old lady was scowling down and snatching up her other packages before Eleanor could reach them, and at last Eleanor rose, smiling in convulsive apology.
"I'm really so sorry," she said.
"Damn you," the little old lady said, but more quietly. "I was taking it home for my little lunch. And now, thanks to you..."
"Perhaps I could pay."
Eleanor took hold of her pocketbook, and the little lady stood very still and thought.
"I couldn't take money just like that," she said at last. "I didn't buy the things, you see, they were left over."
She snapped her lips angrily.
"You should have seen the ham they had," she said. "But someone else got that. And the chocolate cake. And the potato salad. And the little candies in the little paper dishes. I was too late on everything, and now..."
She and Eleanor both glanced down at the mess on the sidewalk, and the little lady said,
"So you see, I couldn't just take money. Not money, just from your hand. Not for something that was left over."
"May I buy you something to replace this, then? I'm in a terrible hurry, but if we could find some place that's open..."
The little old lady smiled wickedly.
"I've still got this, anyway," she said, and she hugged one package tight. "You may pay my taxi fare home," she said. "Then no one else will be likely to knock me down."
"Gladly,"
Eleanor said, and turned to the taxi driver who had been waiting, interested.
"Can you take this lady home?" she asked.
"A couple of dollars will do it," the little lady said, "not including the tip for this gentleman, of course. Being as small as I am," she explained daintily, "it's quite a hazard. Quite a hazard indeed, people knocking you down. Still, it's a genuine pleasure to find one as willing as you to make up for it. Sometimes the people who knock you down never turn once to look."
With Eleanor's help, she climbed into the taxi with her packages, and Eleanor took $2 and a 50-cent piece from her pocketbook and handed them to the little lady, who clutched them tight in her tiny hand.
"All right, sweetheart," the taxi driver said. "Where do we go?"
The little lady chuckled.
"I'll tell you after we start," she said, and then to Eleanor, "Good luck to you, dearie. Watch out from now on how you go knocking people down."
"Goodbye," Eleanor said, "and I'm really very sorry."
"That's fine, then," the little lady said, waving at her as the taxi pulled away from the curb. "I'll be praying for you, dearie."
Well, Eleanor thought, staring after the taxi, "there's one person, anyway, who will be praying for me. One person, anyway." 4. It was the first genuinely shining day of summer, a time of year which brought Eleanor always to aching memories of her early childhood, when it had seemed to be summer all the time. She could not remember a winter before her father's death, on a cold, wet day. She had taken to wondering lately during these swift-counted years, what had been done with all those wasted summer days? How could she have spent them so wantonly? "I am foolish," she told herself early every summer. "I am very foolish. I am grown up now and know the values of things. Nothing is ever really wasted," she believed sensibly, "even one's childhood." And then, each year, one summer morning, the warm wind would come down the city street where she walked, and she would be touched with the little cold thought, "I have let more time go by." Yet this morning, driving the little car which she and her sister owned together, apprehensive lest they might still realize that she had come after all and just taken it away, going docilely along the street, following the lines of traffic, stopping when she was bidden and turning when she could, she smiled out at the sunlight slanting along the street and thought, "I am going. I am going. I have finally taken a step." Always before, when she had her sister's permission to drive the little car, she had gone cautiously, moving with extreme care to avoid even the slightest scratch or mar, which might irritate her sister. But today, with her carton on the back seat and her suitcase on the floor, her gloves and pocketbook and light coat on the seat beside her, the car belonged entirely to her. A little contained world all her own.
I am really going, she thought.
At the last traffic light in the city before she turned to go onto the great highway out of town, she stopped, waiting, and slid Dr. Montague's letter out of her pocketbook. I will not even need a map, she thought. He must be a very careful man. Route 39 to Ashton, the letter said, and then turn left onto Route 5 going west. Follow this for a little less than 30 miles, and you will come to the small village of Hillsdale. Go through Hillsdale to the corner with a gas station on the left and a church on the right, and turn left here onto what seems to be a narrow country road. You will be going up into the hills, and the road is very poor. Follow this road to the end, about 6 miles, and you will come to the gates of Hill House. I am making these directions so detailed because it is inadvisable to stop in Hillsdale to ask your way. The people there are rude to strangers and openly hostile to anyone inquiring about Hill House. I am very happy that you will be joining us in Hill House and will take great pleasure in making your acquaintance on Thursday, the 21st of June. The light changed. She turned onto the highway and was free of the city. No one, she thought, can catch me now. They don't even know which way I'm going. She had never driven far alone before. The notion of dividing her lovely journey into miles and hours was silly. She saw it, bringing her car with precision between the line on the road and the line of trees beside the road, as a passage of moments. Each one knew, carrying her along with them, taking her down a path of incredible novelty to a new place. The journey itself was her positive action, her destination vague, unimagined, perhaps non-existent. She meant to savor each turn of her traveling, loving the road and the trees and the houses and the small, ugly towns, teasing herself with the notion that she might take it into her head to stop just anywhere and never leave again. She might pull her car to the side of the highway, although that was not allowed, she told herself. She would be punished if she really did. And leave it behind, while she wandered off past the trees into the soft, welcoming country beyond. She might wander till she was exhausted, chasing butterflies or following a stream, and then come at nightfall to the hut of some poor woodcutter who would offer her shelter. She might make her home forever in East Barrington or Desmond or the incorporated village of Burke. She might never leave the road at all, but just hurry on and on until the wheels of the car were worn to nothing and she had come to the end of the world. And, she thought, I might just go along to Hill House, where I am expected and where I am being given shelter and room and board, and a small token salary in consideration of forsaking my commitments and involvements in the city and running away to see the world. I wonder what Dr. Montague is like. I wonder what Hill House is like. I wonder who else will be there. She was well away from the city now, watching for the turning onto Route 39, that magic thread of road Dr. Montague had chosen for her, out of all the roads in the world, to bring her safely to him and to Hill House. No other road could lead her from where she was to where she wanted to be. Dr. Montague was confirmed, made infallible. Under the sign which pointed the way to Route 39 was another sign saying, Ashton, 121 miles. The road, her intimate friend now, turned and dipped, going around turns where surprises waited. Once a cow, regarding her over a fence. Once an incurious dog. Down into hollows where small towns lay, past fields and orchards. On the main street of one village she passed a vast house, pillared and walled, with shutters over the windows, and a pair of stone lions guarding the steps. And she thought that perhaps she might live there, dusting the lions each morning and patting their heads good night. Time is beginning this morning in June, she assured herself. but it is a time that is strangely new and of itself. In these few seconds, I have lived a lifetime in a house with two lions in front. Every morning, I swept the porch and dusted the lions, and every evening, I patted their heads goodnight, and once a week, I washed their faces and manes and paws with warm water and soda, and cleaned between their teeth with a swab. Inside the house, the rooms were tall and clear, with shining floors and polished windows. A little dainty old lady took care of me, moving starchily with a silver tea service on a tray and bringing me a glass of elderberry wine each evening for my health's sake. I took my dinner alone in the long, quiet dining room at the gleaming table, and between the tall windows, the white paneling of the walls shone in the candlelight. I dined upon a bird and radishes from the garden and homemade plum jam. When I slept, it was under a canopy of white organdy, and a nightlight guarded me from the hall. People bowed to me on the streets of the town because everyone was very proud of my lions. When I died... She had left the town far behind by now, and was going past dirty closed lunch stands and torn signs. There had been a fair somewhere near here once, long ago, with motorcycle races. The signs still carried fragments of words. Dare, one of them read, and another, evil. And she laughed at herself, perceiving how she sought out omens everywhere. The word is daredevil, Eleanor, daredevil drivers. And she slowed her car because she was driving too fast and might reach Hill House too soon. At one spot, she stopped altogether beside the road to stare in disbelief and wonder. Along the road, for perhaps a quarter of a mile, she had been passing and admiring a row of splendid tended oleanders, blooming pink and white in a steady row. Now she had come to the gateway they protected, and past the gateway, the trees continued. The gateway was no more than a pair of ruined stone pillars, with a road leading away between them into empty fields. She could see that the oleander trees cut away from the road and ran up each side of a great square, and she could see all the way to the farther side of the square, which was a line of oleander trees seemingly going along a little river. Inside the oleander square, there was nothing. No house, no building. Nothing but the straight road going across and ending at the stream. Now what was here, she wondered. What was here and is gone? Or what was going to be here and never came? Was it going to be a house, or a garden, or an orchard? Were they driven away forever, or are they coming back? Oleanders are poisonous, she remembered. Could they be here guarding something? Will I, she thought, will I get out of my car and go between the ruined gates and then, once I am in the magic oleander square, find that I have wandered into a fairyland, protected poisonously from the eyes of people passing? Once I have stepped between the magic gate posts, will I find myself through the protective barrier, the spell broken? I will go into a sweet garden with fountains and low benches and roses trained over arbors and find one path, jeweled perhaps with rubies and emeralds, soft enough for a king's daughter to walk upon with her little sandaled feet, and it will lead me directly to the palace which lies under a spell. I will walk up low stone steps past stone lions guarding and into a courtyard where a fountain plays and the queen waits weeping for the princess to return. She will drop her embroidery when she sees me and cry out to the palace servants, stirring at last after their long sleep, to prepare a great feast because the enchantment is ended and the palace is itself again. And we shall live happily ever after. No, of course, she thought, turning to start her car again.
Once the palace becomes visible and the spell is broken, the whole spell will be broken, and all this countryside outside the Oleanders will return to its proper form, fading away. Towns and signs and cows into a soft green picture from a fairy tale. Then coming down from the hills, there will be a prince riding bright in green and silver, with 100 bowmen riding behind him, pennants stirring, horses tossing, jewels flashing.
She laughed and turned to smile goodbye at the magic Oleanders. Another day, she told them, another day I'll come back and break your spell.
She stopped for lunch after she had driven 100 miles and a mile. She found a country restaurant which advertised itself as an old mill, and found herself seated incredibly upon a balcony over a dashing stream, looking down upon wet rocks and the intoxicating sparkle of moving water, with a cut-glass bowl of cottage cheese on the table before her and corn sticks in a napkin. Because this was a time and a land where enchantments were swiftly made and broken, she wanted to linger over her lunch, knowing that Hill House always waited for her at the end of her day. The only other people in the dining room were a family party, a mother and father with a small boy and girl, and they talked to one another softly and gently. And once, the little girl turned and regarded Eleanor with frank curiosity, and after a minute, smiled. The lights from the stream below touched the ceiling and the polished tables and glanced along the little girl's curls, and the little girl's mother said, "She wants her cup of stars." Eleanor looked up, surprised. The little girl was sliding back in her chair, sullenly refusing her milk, while her father frowned, and her brother giggled, and her mother said calmly, "She wants her cup of stars."
"Indeed, yes," Eleanor thought. "Indeed, so do I. A cup of stars, of course."
"Her little cup," the mother was explaining, smiling apologetically at the waitress, who was thunderstruck at the thought that the mill's good country milk was not rich enough for the little girl. "It has stars in the bottom, and she always drinks her milk from it at home. She calls it her cup of stars because she can see the stars while she drinks her milk."
The waitress nodded, unconvinced, and the mother told the little girl,
"You'll have your milk from your cup of stars tonight when we get home, but just for now, just to be a very good little girl, will you take a little milk from this glass?"
"Don't do it," Eleanor told the little girl. "Insist on your cup of stars. Once they have trapped you into being like everyone else, you will never see your cup of stars again. Don't do it."
And the little girl glanced at her and smiled a little subtle, dimpling, wholly comprehending smile, and shook her head stubbornly at the glass.
"Brave girl," Eleanor thought. "Wise, brave girl."
"You're spoiling her," the father said. "She ought not to be allowed these whims."
"Just this once," the mother said. She put down the glass of milk and touched the little girl gently on the hand.
"Eat your ice cream," she said.
When they left, the little girl waved goodbye to Eleanor, and Eleanor waved back, sitting in joyful loneliness to finish her coffee, while the gay stream tumbled along below her. "I have not very much farther to go," Eleanor thought. "I'm more than halfway there." Journey's end, she thought, and far back in her mind, sparkling like the little stream, a tag end of a tune danced through her head, bringing distantly a word or so. "In delay there lies no plenty," she thought. "In delay there lies no plenty." She nearly stopped forever just outside Ashton, because she came to a tiny cottage buried in a garden. "I could live there all alone," she thought, slowing the car to look down the winding garden path to the small blue front door with, perfectly, a white cat on the step. "No one would ever find me there either, behind all those roses, and just to make sure I would plant oleanders by the road. I will light a fire in the cool evenings and toast apples at my own hearth,
I will raise white cats and sew white curtains for the windows, and sometimes come out of my door to go to the store to buy cinnamon and tea and thread. People will come to me to have their fortunes told, and I will brew love potions for sad maidens. I will have a robin.
But the cottage was far behind, and it was time to look for her new road so carefully charted by Dr. Montague. "Turn left onto Route 5 going west," his letter said. And as efficiently and promptly as though he had been guiding her from some spot far away, moving her car with controls in his hands, it was done. She was on Route 5 going west, and her journey was nearly done. In spite of what he said, though, she thought, "I will stop in Hillsdale for a minute, just for a cup of coffee, because I cannot bear to have my long trip end so soon." It was not really disobeying, anyway. The letter said it was inadvisable to stop in Hillsdale to ask the way, not forbidden to stop for coffee. And perhaps, if I don't mention Hill House, I will not be doing wrong. Anyway, she thought obscurely, it's my last chance. Hillsdale was upon her before she knew it. A tangled, disorderly mess of dirty houses and crooked streets. It was small. Once she had come onto the main street, she could see the corner at the end with the gas station and the church. There seemed to be only one place to stop for coffee, and that was an unattractive diner. But Eleanor was bound to stop in Hillsdale, and so she brought her car to the broken curb in front of the diner and got out. After a minute's thought, with a silent nod to Hillsdale, she locked the car, mindful of her suitcase on the floor and the carton on the back seat. "I will not spend long in Hillsdale," she thought, looking up and down the street, which managed, even in the sunlight, to be dark and ugly. A dog slept uneasily in the shade against a wall. A woman stood in a doorway across the street and looked at Eleanor, and two young boys lounged against a fence, elaborately silent. Eleanor, who was afraid of strange dogs and jeering women and young hoodlums, went quickly into the diner, clutching her pocketbook and her car keys. Inside, she found a counter with a chinless, tired girl behind it and a man sitting at the end eating. She wondered briefly how hungry he must have been to come in here at all. When she looked at the gray counter and the smeared glass bowl over a plate of donuts.
"Coffee," she said to the girl behind the counter,
and the girl turned wearily and tumbled down a cup from the piles on the shelves. "I will have to drink this coffee because I said I was going to," Eleanor told herself sternly, "but next time I will listen to Dr. Montague." There was some elaborate joke going on between the man eating and the girl behind the counter. When she set Eleanor's coffee down, she glanced at him and half-smiled, and he shrugged, and then the girl laughed.
Eleanor looked up, but the girl was examining her fingernails, and the man was wiping his plate with bread. Perhaps Eleanor's coffee was poisoned. It certainly looked it. Determined to plumb the village of Hillsdale to its lowest depths, Eleanor said to the girl,
"I'll have one of those donuts too, please."
And the girl, glancing sideways at the man, slid one of the donuts onto a dish and set it down in front of Eleanor and laughed when she caught another look from the man.
"This is a pretty little town," Eleanor said to the girl. "What is it called?" The girl stared at her. Perhaps no one had ever before had the audacity to call Hillsdale a pretty little town.
After a moment, the girl looked again at the man as though calling for confirmation and said,
"Hillsdale." "Have you lived here long?" Eleanor asked.
"I'm not going to mention Hill House," she assured Dr. Montague far away. "I just want to waste a little time."
"Yeah," the girl said. "It must be pleasant living in a small town like this. I come from the city."
"Yeah?"
"Do you like it here?"
"It's all right," the girl said. She looked again at the man who was listening carefully. Not much to do.
How large a town is it?
Pretty small. You want more coffee? This was addressed to the man who was rattling his cup against his saucer, and Eleanor took a first, shuddering sip of her own coffee and wondered how he could possibly want more.
Do you have a lot of visitors around here?
She asked when the girl had filled the coffee cup and gone back to lounge against the shelves.
Tourists, I mean?
What for? For a minute, the girl flashed at her from what might have been an emptiness greater than Eleanor had ever known.
Why would anybody come here?
She looked sullenly at the man and added, "It's not even a movie."
But the hills are so pretty. Mostly with small, out-of-the-way towns like this one, you'll find city people who have come and built themselves homes up in the hills. For privacy.
The girl laughed shortly.
Not here they don't. Or remodeling old houses.
Privacy, the girl said and laughed again.
It just seems surprising,
Eleanor said, feeling the man looking at her. Yeah, the girl said. If they'd put in a movie, even.
I thought, Eleanor said carefully, that I might even look around. Old houses are usually cheap, you know, and it's fun to make them over.
Not around here, the girl said.
Then, Eleanor said, there are no old houses around here back in the hills?
Nope. The man rose, taking change from his pocket, and spoke for the first time. People leave this town, he said. They don't come here. When the door closed behind him, the girl turned her flat eyes back to Eleanor almost resentfully, as though Eleanor, with her chatter, had driven the man away. He was right, she said finally. They go away, the lucky ones.
Why don't you run away? Eleanor asked her, and the girl shrugged.
Would I be any better off? She asked. She took Eleanor's money without interest and returned the change. Then, with another of her quick flashes, she glanced at the empty plates at the end of the counter and almost smiled. He comes in every day, she said. When Eleanor smiled back and started to speak, the girl turned her back and busied herself with the cups on the shelves, and Eleanor, feeling herself dismissed, rose gratefully from her coffee and took up her car keys and pocketbook.
Goodbye, Eleanor said,
and the girl, back still turned, said, good luck to you. I hope you find your house. Five. The road leading away from the gas station and the church was very poor indeed, deeply rutted and rocky. Eleanor's little car stumbled and bounced, reluctant to go farther into these unattractive hills, where the day seemed quickly drawing to an end under the thick, oppressive trees on either side. They do not really seem to have much traffic on this road, Eleanor thought wryly, turning the wheel quickly to avoid a particularly vicious rock ahead. 6 miles of this will not do the car any good. And for the first time in hours, she thought of her sister and laughed. By now they would surely know that she had taken the car and gone, but they would not know where. They would be telling each other incredulously that they would never have suspected it of Eleanor. I would never have suspected it of myself, she thought. Laughing still.
Everything is different. I'm a new person, very far from home. In delay there lies no plenty. Present mirth hath present laughter.
And she gasped as the car cracked against a rock and reeled back across the road with an ominous scraping somewhere beneath, but then gathered itself together valiantly and resumed its dogged climb. The tree branches brushed against the windshield, and it grew steadily darker. Hill House likes to make an entrance, she thought. I wonder if the sun ever shines along here. At last, with one final effort, the car cleared a tangle of dead leaves and small branches across the road and came into a clearing by the gate of Hill House.
Why am I here? She thought helplessly and at once. Why am I here?
The gate was tall and ominous and heavy, set strongly into a stone wall which went off through the trees. Even from the car, she could see the padlock and the chain that was twisted around and through the bars. Beyond the gate, she could see only that the road continued, turned, shadowed on either side by the still dark trees. Since the gate was so clearly locked, locked and double locked and chained and barred, who, she wondered, wants so badly to get in? She made no attempt to get out of the car, but pressed the horn, and the trees and the gate shuddered and withdrew slightly from the sound. After a minute, she blew the horn again, and then saw a man coming toward her from inside the gate. He was as dark and unwelcoming as the padlock, and before he moved toward the gate, he peered through the bars at her, scowling.
What you want?
His voice was sharp, mean.
I want to come in, please. Please unlock the gate.
Who say?
Why, she faltered. I'm supposed to come in, she said at last.
What for?
I am expected.
Or am I? She wondered suddenly. Is this as far as I go?
Who by?
She knew, of course, that he was delighting in exceeding his authority, as though once he moved to unlock the gate, he would lose the little temporary superiority he thought he had. And what superiority have I? She wondered. I am outside the gate, after all. She could already see that losing her temper, which she did rarely because she was so afraid of being ineffectual, would only turn him away, leaving her still outside the gate, railing futilely. She could even anticipate his innocence if he were reproved later for this arrogance, the maliciously vacant grin, the wide, blank eyes, the whining voice protesting that he would have let her in. He planned to let her in, but how could he be sure? He had his orders, didn't he? And he had to do what he was told. He'd be the one to get in trouble, wouldn't he, if he let in someone who wasn't supposed to be inside? She could anticipate his shrug and, picturing him, laughed. Perhaps the worst thing she could have done. Eyeing her, he moved back from the gate.
You better come back later,
he said, and turned his back with an air of virtuous triumph.
Listen,
she called after him, still trying not to sound angry.
I am one of Dr. Montague's guests. He will be expecting me in the house. Please listen to me.
He turned and grinned at her.
They couldn't rightly be expecting you, he said, seeing as you're the only ones come so far.
Do you mean that there's no one in the house?
No one I know of. Maybe my wife getting it fixed up. So they couldn't be there exactly expecting you, now could they?
She sat back against the car seat and closed her eyes. Hill House, she thought, you're as hard to get into as heaven.
I suppose you know what you're asking for coming here. I suppose they told you back in the city. You hear anything about this place?
I heard that I was invited here as a guest of Dr. Montague's. When you open the gates, I will go inside.
I'll open them. I'm going to open them. I just want to be sure you know what's waiting for you in there. You ever been here before? One of the family, maybe?
He looked at her now, peering through the bars, his jeering face one more barrier after padlock and chain.
I can't let you in till I'm sure, can I? What'd you say your name was?
She sighed.
Eleanor Vance?
Not one of the family, then, I guess. You ever hear anything about this place?
It's my chance, I suppose, she thought. I'm being given a last chance. I could turn my car around right here and now in front of these gates and go away from here, and no one would blame me. Anyone has a right to run away.
She put her head out through the car window and said with fury,
My name is Eleanor Vance. I am expected in Hill House. Unlock those gates at once.
All right, all right.
Deliberately, making a wholly unnecessary display of fitting the key and turning it, he opened the padlock and loosened the chain and swung the gates just wide enough for the car to come through. Eleanor moved the car slowly, but the alacrity with which he leaped to the side of the road made her think for a minute that he had perceived the fleeting impulse crossing her mind. She laughed, and then stopped the car, because he was coming toward her, safely from the side.
"You won't like it," he said. "You'll be sorry I ever opened that gate."
"Out of the way, please," she said. "You've held me up long enough."
"You think they could get anyone else to open this gate? You think anyone else would stay around here that long except me and my wife? You think we can't have things just about the way we want them? Long as we stay around here and fix up the house and open the gates for all you city people think you know everything.
Please get away from my car."
She dared not admit to herself that he frightened her, for fear that he might perceive it. His nearness, leaning against the side of the car, was ugly, and his enormous resentment puzzled her. She had certainly made him open the gate for her, but did he think of the house and gardens inside as his own? A name from Dr. Montague's letter came into her mind, and she asked curiously,
"Are you Dudley the caretaker?"
"Yes, I'm Dudley the caretaker," he mimicked her. "Who else do you think would be around here?"
The honest old family retainer, she thought, proud and loyal and thoroughly unpleasant.
"You and your wife take care of the house all alone?"
"Who else?"
It was his boast, his curse, his refrain. She moved restlessly, afraid to draw away from him too obviously, and yet wanting with small motions of starting the car to make him stand aside.
"I'm sure you'll be able to make us very comfortable, you and your wife," she said, putting a tone of finality into her voice. "Meanwhile, I'm very anxious to get to the house as soon as possible."
He snickered disagreeably.
"Me now," he said. "Me? I don't hang around here after dark."
Grinning, satisfied with himself, he stood away from the car, and Eleanor was grateful, although awkward, starting the car under his eye. "Perhaps he will keep popping out at me all along the drive," she thought. "A sneering Cheshire cat yelling each time that I should be happy to find anyone willing to hang around this place until dark, anyway." To show that she was not at all affected by the thought of the face of Dudley the caretaker between the trees, she began to whistle, a little annoyed to find that the same tune still ran through her head. "Present mirth hath present laughter." And she told herself crossly that she must really make an effort to think of something else. She was sure that the rest of the words must be most unsuitable to hide so stubbornly from her memory, and probably wholly disreputable to be caught singing on her arrival at Hill House. Over the trees, occasionally, between them and the hills, she caught glimpses of what must be the roofs, perhaps a tower, of Hill House. They made houses so oddly back when Hill House was built, she thought. They put towers and turrets and buttresses and wooden lace on them, even sometimes Gothic spires and gargoyles. Nothing was ever left undecorated. Perhaps Hill House has a tower or a secret chamber, or even a passageway going off into the hills and probably used by smugglers. Although, what could smugglers find to smuggle around these lonely hills? "Perhaps I will encounter a devilishly handsome smuggler and..." She turned her car onto the last stretch of straight drive, leading her directly, face to face, to Hill House, and moving without thought, pressed her foot on the brake to stall the car and sat staring. The house was vile. She shivered and thought, the words coming freely into her mind.
"Hill House is vile. It is diseased. Get away from here at once."
Chapter 2. No human eye can isolate the unhappy coincidence of line and place, which suggests